Good morning and welcome to Wanda Six, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We're playing Archie Shep's Cousin Mary, and as I mentioned on the Wednesday show that we were doing a shout-out to my cousin Mary Lee Lewis, who at 93 made her transition on November 1st, and yesterday was the homegoing in Bay St. Louis, and it was really, really beautiful, beautiful day. Surrounded by a lot of loved ones, and it's a real fitting send-off to a wonderful, wonderful spirit known as Miss Mary. And I didn't realize until her sister, Susie Burton of Purlington, Mississippi, spoke a little bit before she sang, that Cousin Mary was actually a twin, and her sister's, her departed twin sister, her name was Martha, and the eulogy that was given by Cousin Mary's pastor, Alan D. Jenkins, talked about the two sisters, the biblical two sisters, Mary and Martha, and it was really, really, really wonderful, and it was just really wonderful. So it was really great to be surrounded by all this family, some I knew and some I didn't know, and cousins, and seeing my mother's sister, Auntie Henrietta, which is really, really beautiful. So, and it's also interesting, amazing that Cousin Mary is interred at St. Mary's Cemetery in Bay St. Louis. So it's like, wow, all these Marys. And she was laid to rest right next to one of her daughters who preceded her in death, Gaynell Lewis Richard, and her husband on the other side of her, Paul Lewis. Actually, Paul Lewis, her husband, Gaynell, would be between the two of them. So that was pretty, too. So I'm going to play the rest of this piece, Cousin Mary, and then we're going to go right into an interview with David Hardiman Sr., who is going to talk about the fundraiser for the American Cancer Society and the CD release party for the San Francisco All-Star Big Band, the 35th anniversary of this big band, on Monday, November 12th. And it's going to feature, this concert is going to feature Dennis Perrier, Nina Causey, and D. Anthony Hardiman, who is David Hardiman's son. And it's going to really be a great, great show. And I'm going to play a piece from that particular CD. He's going to talk about it. Professor Hardiman is going to talk about it. And it's called Santos by the Sea. And I thought that would be kind of fitting because New Orleans is a port city, and Bay St. Louis is right in the Gulf. You can see the beach no matter where you are. In the city, from Cousin Mary's house, you could almost look down and see the water. And the CD release party and fundraiser for the American Cancer Society, again, is on Monday at 8 o'clock. It's going to be one show with two sets. And for tickets, you can call 415-655-5600, 415-655-5600. And, again, that's at Yoshi's in San Francisco. And just because we're talking about angels and Cousin Mary, I'm sure, is with them, I thought it would be really fitting to go do one of my archival interview retrievals of a great interview with Della Reese, who plays Tess in Touched by an Angel. And if there's some more time left over, we're going to go back to another wonderful interview with Ava DuVernay, whose film Middle of Nowhere is actually, if you're in New Orleans, which is where I am right now. The film is at the Zeitgeist Multidisciplinary Arts Center, and it's playing right now. And then if you are in San Francisco, then it's still at the UA Stonestown, and it's playing there, and it's really making some wonderful rounds. It's still in Los Angeles. It's in Philadelphia. It's in New York, the film I Will Follow. Excuse me, no, not I Will Follow. That's the other film that Ava directed. That was her first feature. But this one here, Middle of Nowhere, is also in Newark. It's in Irvine. It's in Las Vegas. And it's in Leavenworth. It's in New York in quite a few places. And Los Angeles, quite a few places. It's in Chicago. Atlanta is opening on the 9th, which is today. It's an opening at Athens today as well. In Columbus today, Fort Wayne today, Nashville next week, Columbia next week, Denver a couple of weeks from now. And so there's opportunities to see the film, Middle of Nowhere. You don't want to miss it. It's a story that sort of looks at the prison industrial complex, looks at the prison system in a more intimate way, and shows how when someone is incarcerated, it affects not just them, but affects all of their loved ones. And this particular film looks at a couple, a husband and wife, and what happens when the husband is incarcerated. So it's a really wonderful, wonderful piece. So we're going to let you listen to the last of Cousin Mary, and maybe I'll play the whole thing a little bit later on in the show. Oh my, I talked through the whole song. I apologize for that. Well, I'll definitely have to play that again. So let me play the interview right now with David Hardiman. Maybe I'll start with, since we sort of shortchanged you on that. Let's start with Santos by the Sea, and then we'll go right into the interview.
Thank you.
That was the David Hardiman on the trumpet, and that was from the San Francisco All-Star Big Band 37th anniversary CD. That was Santos by the Sea. And here's the interview that he and I had a couple of days ago talking about this great event, which is also a fundraiser on Monday, November 12th at Yoshi's in San Francisco. 8 o'clock, one show, two sets.
It was really great seeing you, Mr. Hardiman, at the special tribute concert for Ed Kelly and the unveiling of that wonderful portrait that James Scales painted this past Friday at the Oakland Public Conservatory.
Yes, I was really happy that they were doing that with all the friends and people who knew Ed Kelly, and mm-hmm. he definitely was deserving of having that type of tribute.
Right. Yeah. And I really like what you shared. And then when you were talking about how, you know, he had the East Bay and you had San Francisco, you're both professors, you know, at respective community colleges.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the era in which we all were trying to keep it alive and in living color.
mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you mentioned the professor Bill Bell out at College of Alameda.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mhm. Yes, and there was Fred Berry over at College of San Mateo, in mm-hmm. which he's mm-hmm. still, I think he's retired from there now, but he's also part-time at Stanford University, in which Dr. Bill Bell has also taught over there, as well as at UC Berkeley, too. Mm-hmm. It's a part of that young people's program they have in the summertime at UC Berkeley.
Right. Yeah. So how easy was it for you to come to the West Coast, I believe, in 1971, you know, where you started teaching at Berkeley Unified School District and Martin Luther King Junior High, to become head of a music department at, you know, one of the community colleges. You know, San Francisco Community College District is very well known and respected. And,
right. Well, yeah. You know, it was a time period, it seemed, that the time was right, because I was brought in as an affirmative action type of hiree at King Junior High School in Berkeley. I mentioned Dr. Bill Bell and Dr. Willis Kirk. Mm-hmm. Those were two of the people that helped to bring me in at King Junior High School. Then after being there for about almost 4 years, then I was part-time at City College and Alameda and Contra Costa.
Oh.
Then I've more or less opened up a new full-time position at City College, and then was able to develop more of a complete jazz studies program within the music department at City College San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And you were there how many years?
30 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then how do you pass it on to your son? How does that work? That's really cool.
Well, it was very cool because fortunately he had gone to City College. He graduated with a bachelor's from Cal State Hayward,
mm-hmm.
and now East Bay, they call it. And then he got his master's at San Francisco State. And then, of course, because he's been working with me in my big band as well as attending schools and playing as a performer and getting his credentials and all of that, then he was the perfect person to put in there because he had worked with me. And then I've been working with him all along because he runs into situations or something and he will call me and I'll give him some guidance or advice about how to deal with certain situations, and he seems to be doing really well. I'm very proud of him.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because what's really well known about you know, that department that you set up was how you had these concerts where you invited the community in. You have these famous musicians come and perform with the student orchestra.
Right. Well, in fact, December the 11th, Tuesday night, will be the City College Advanced Jazz Band and Jazz Rock Improv Workshop,
mm-hmm.
and we'll bring in Melvin Ryan, organist, some B3 organ player, piano player,
mm-hmm.
that used to play with Wes Montgomery,
mm-hmm.
as well as T-Bone Walker and B.B. King, and is a fantastic piano player, organist that we were teenagers coming up together and played in a group called the Monarchs.
Mm-hmm.
And
like the butterflies.
Yeah, and then, so you see, he's one of my longtime friends that we're bringing him in, fortunately, as a guest artist, so I'm looking forward to that. We might even possibly be able to get him over to 57th Street Gallery that Monday night before. I'm working on that idea right now. And then possibly going into the studio on that Wednesday and doing some recording.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, so you're from Indianapolis?
Indianapolis, Indiana.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, you play with everybody. You know, Gladys Knight, the Pips, Nancy Wilson, Jackie Wilson, the Dells, the Honeycombs, Donny Hathaway, Johnny Ray. I mean, it's like Johnny Otis here.
Well, you know, I've been fortunate, but it all has to do with having that educational background and studying and learning how to read, because when I came along at Indiana University, they didn't even have a jazz studies program at all, and you had no choice but to graduate as a classical musician. Nowadays, that's one of the most honored jazz programs in the country, with Dr. David Baker, who's also a friend of mine that has that program, or has had it for many years.
Wow. And this big band, I mean, you've got, I mean, not many, you know, leaders have a big band, because one thing is kind of hard to keep it together. And your big band, your San Francisco All-Star, I mean, everybody is a star in his or her own right. Big band is in its 37th anniversary, and you have a CD release party coming up on November 12th that you are also sharing this evening with the American Cancer Society as a fundraiser. Talk about your big band, and how do you keep it together for 37 years?
Well, it's no easy task, I guarantee you that.
Mm-hmm.
I've only had a few of the band members, such as Dr. Willis Kirk on drums and Frank Fisher on trumpet, and Charles Hamilton's been there too since almost day one, and he used to be the director, teacher over at Berklee High School with that famous Berklee High School band, jazz bands.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a matter of trying to, when I put it together in 75, trying to put my hands on the greatest and best people in the Bay Area and pull them together, and then try to keep it going. Because, like they say, it's a labor of love. It's not one of those big money-making projects that you think would be happening, because big bands are expensive to have them performing. So we perform whenever we can, but it's not that easy to have a performance, because we're looking at, generally speaking, just to pay each musician about $100, you're talking about $2,000 plus.
Mhm. Yeah. Well, certainly, you all are together because you love the music, and since everyone is an all-star, that means that this is not their main gig.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's it. You know, we have people like Calvin Keyes, who's a super a recording artist with about 12 CDs or so, and then Denise Perrier's singing with us. She's recording artist Nina Causey.
Mm-hmm.
My son D'Anthony, he's got a couple of his own. He has one new pop CD that he's done all the music, I Am Me, it's called. And then mm-hmm. he's done a gospel single called I Feel Good Today
mm-hmm.
on YouTube. It has about 1,200 to 1,300 views on it. And he's really surprised at that. But then, see, we have other people who have played with a lot of the greats. And I always say collectively, we've all played and been all over the world with the people who are in the band. So that's one of the reasons why we call it the All-Star Big Band, because we've had people like Bishop Norman Williams and John Handy, Jules Brassard. There's a long list of people that have played in the band over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So, talk about the this fundraiser for the American Cancer Society. I don't remember at the last All Star concert if that was also a fundraiser. Do you normally have a fundraiser in connection to these performances?
Well, not generally, but October 24th last year mm-hmm. at Yoshi San Francisco is when I had my first American Cancer Society fundraiser, which this one will be the second one,
mm-hmm.
November 12th. It's one of those kind of things where some of the musicians in the band have overcome cancer in one form or the other,
mm-hmm.
and also in my personal family, my brother passed away with lung cancer. I had a girlfriend. She was only about 42.
Mm.
She passed with breast cancer. And then, of course, other family members and other friends that disproportionately, it seems like, African Americans are affected with cancer in one form or the other and are pass away as a result of it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And you actually have a CD release party happening. It's just like so much you're celebrating on November 12th. I mean.
Well, that's it. this is why I'm doing it. It's a twofold purpose, and the fact is that we're getting it out there, the CD called 37th Anniversary,
mm-hmm.
David Hardiman, San Francisco All-Star Big Band, and it literally has gone throughout the country. Has been released, and it's been sent to most of the major radio stations that play jazz throughout the country and even to some other countries also.
Mm-hmm.
It's on line at CD Baby. So it's one of those kind of things where online, that's where music is being sold nowadays rather than in the record shops, because there aren't that many record shops anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So talk about, you've got 12 songs on this particular project, and I don't know, they seem to be classics.
Right. Well, that's it. We have several of Frank Fisher's arrangements, in which he has been one of my, that's a trumpet player that I have mentioned. I think he's turning 86 about now.
Mm.
And
wow.
He's a fantastic arranger-composer, in which he did a lot of the writing for the very beginning of the band. And that was part of the project that we were playing music by the musicians who had written and arranged music. And the music that's on the CD is a compilation of things that we recorded back in 91 at City College as a project for the radio TV department there,
mm-hmm.
In their studio, and then one live recording done in 2009 when we were first there, which Denise Perrier is doing a Duke Ellington medley, and that's written, or rather arranged by Wayne Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
who's a prominent trombone player in the area, and he's played with me before. And then Nina Causey's singing, "He May Be Your Man, But He Comes to See Me Sometimes," which is an old Alberta Hunter song.
Oh, I like her.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, her story is amazing.
Yes. So, you know, there's a lot of material on there. Mm-hmm. There's a song that's called Portrait of David Hardiman, which was written for me by Jules Rowell, a trombone player.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also on my Portrait of David Hardiman sextet CD that I released a couple of years ago now.
Right.
And then there's Santos by the Sea, which was written by Dr. Willis Kirk from when he was in Brazil playing with Earl Father Hines. And it's a nice Brazilian feeling, and we really like that song, Santos by the Sea, because that's when I get a chance to play a little solo on there.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And then you got a piece, the last one is called Mini Skirts. Who did that?
That's Frank Fisher's song.
Oh, okay.
And see, so Frank has, you know, he's from Texas, and he has a great sense of humor. And so Mini Skirts goes back to the day, back in the day, like they say now, when the mini skirts were happening. So I don't know, what do they call them nowadays, because they're higher than mini skirts. But it's kind of from that style of what, back in the 60s and 70s, when mini skirts were the big thing, right? New
right.
thing for the girls to wear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You might have already said it, but I missed it because I didn't jot it down. So how many musicians does your big band have, and then how many musicians does one need to have officially a big band?
Well, okay. Generally, a big band can be anywhere from 17 to 20 pieces.
Okay.
And mine is generally a 19-piece big band, but we're having two vocalists instead of just one. And then David Anthony, my son, plays trumpet with the band, and then, of course, he's singing the pop music. So we end up having three vocalists, and he's doing double duty there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really cool. So what is it about the big band that, you know, that you enjoy so much as an arranger and conductor that has, you know, made it so that you wanted to continue, well, first have a band, a big band, and then to continue with? Because, you know, we think about some of the great band leaders, and there aren't a whole lot of them that had big bands. And I'm trying to think, maybe you could name some of them, because my brain is not working well right at the moment.
You mean the big band leaders?
Yeah, yeah, some that come to mind when you think
of course.
About
it. There's the fantastic, one of the greatest composer arrangers and big band leaders in the world was Duke Ellington.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Count Basie, Earl Father Hines. There was Jimmy Lunsford. And then, of course, then we had people like Stan Kenton. And there are a whole group of musicians and big band leaders that have passed on their legacy. And some of the bands are still going. Not too many of the ones that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But the Basie band is still performing.
Right.
Even after Basie's death. And Ellington's orchestra also after his death.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're keeping the legacy going. Now, what I've experienced in playing with some of the stars, playing the shows when they would come through Indianapolis and or the Bay Area, I had the privilege of playing, like you said, with and behind people like Gladys Knight and the Pips and people of that sort. Nancy Wilson, so on. You know, it's all professional, and it's all the A++ rating of musicians that are performing when they come through. we have a rehearsal, and then we generally do the show. So there's not much opportunity for mistakes there.
Mm-hmm.
But in playing with a few bands here in the Bay Area when I first came in, but their quality was not that good. So that was one of the reasons why I formed my band with the best people I could find and try to keep the quality up to professional level.
Mm-hmm.
But then also teaching at City College and at Alameda, directing the advanced jazz bands, trying to get those students so that they can also play big band music, so that they can become professional musicians and play shows and or in other big bands or orchestras. So it's been something that I have done simultaneously with the school bands as well as my professional band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking last night, went to Yoshi's in San Francisco and saw Dwight Tribble, and just thinking about him just now, I thought about Horace Tapscott.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a big band.
Right.
Yeah, the Pan-African People's Orchestra.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and they're still around, too.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's it. See, there have been several bands that are still in existence. And when you really think about it, every major college university,
mm-hmm.
they have most of the time now big bands that are studying and performing. And so those students have an opportunity now to be able to go on out and play professionally in such bands as you mentioned, Horace Tapscott and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a matter of passing it on and keeping the legacy and the heritage going, because that's a very important part of it. If you notice on TV, whenever they have some of the shows, there's an orchestra that's performing live behind a lot of the artists.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys, regardless of where they are, whether they're in New York or Hollywood or someplace, you know, those are definitely some of the best musicians that they have there. I had the pleasure of directing what's called the African American Jazz Caucus Dance Band, which was part of the African American Jazz Caucus and the International Association of Negro Musicians,
mm-hmm.
for 6 years. And we would, for those conferences, I would go to several cities. We played for the conferences in New York about 3 times, in Toronto, Canada a couple of times, Long Beach, several of the other major cities. And these were educators coming together and playing together in like an all-star band.
Mm-hmm. That's really nice. Yeah, I was just thinking about how a lot of times one might have like a jazz musician playing with like a symphony orchestra.
Yes.
Yeah, and however, if you have your own, you know, big band, then you wouldn't necessarily need a symphony orchestra, because you know, the big band a lot of times can play, you know, all different kinds of music.
Right. Well, that's true. And when you think about an orchestra, a real symphony orchestra, of course, then you're talking about the addition of several many strings,
mm-hmm.
and violins, violas, cellos, and string basses.
Right.
And then that's what you find happening on a lot of these special presentations and shows. I had the pleasure of playing with the Golden Gate Park Band for 20 years, which was a concert band music and Golden Gate Park band shell there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of the classical training background that I had when I studied at Indiana University and Butler University.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, I am really looking forward to the CD release party and the fundraiser for the American Cancer Society featuring the San Francisco All-Star Big Band 37th anniversary. So you're really going to have something big when you make 40, huh?
Big. It's going to be even bigger. I don't know how much bigger. But
I don't know either, because these are huge. I mean, you know, you got 19, you know, members of the All-Star.
But we'll have 20.
20. Okay, 20 with the singers. Okay, yeah. And then Miss Perrier, she's like featured on a whole lot of these songs. Everywhere there's vocals, it's mostly her. And then, you know, the musicians that are featured vary, but you got Sweetie Mitchell on a couple, and Nina Causey on one, but
yeah.
Then you got Denise Perrier on like what, four, five.
She's doing the Ellington Medley, see?
Oh, okay.
What I didn't talk about was Sweetie Mitchell, who has passed on. She was our first vocalist, and she passed on. Unfortunately, she had diabetes, and but she was practically the number one jazz singer here in the Fillmore district in San Francisco for many years. Even Mary Stallings would say that that Sweetie Mitchell was the lady.
Oh.
So I had the pleasure of having her in the big band. So yes, she is on that 37th anniversary CD. That reminds me, I've also had Mary Stallings sing with me before too, several times.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. So you know everybody, huh?
Well, I know the people who are pretty much prominent in the Bay Area on purpose. I kind of know who's doing what most of the time.
Yeah. So these CDs are a way to sort of capture that history.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it's about, because when you really think about it, some of these musicians go back long before I ever came to the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know the history for San Francisco and the Bay Area.
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, though, maybe they hadn't recorded a lot.
Well, that's true, too, because but then some of them have recorded with other people.
Right.
And so they are recording artists too within their own right.
Yeah. Be great maybe for your 40th to have a movie.
That would be great, wouldn't it? Well, in fact, we'll probably have some videotaping like I did last year. And ideally try to put a DVD together would be really great, and then try to get something on YouTube.
Yeah, that'd be really nice, you know, like to sort of show, you know, some of the high points of the 40 years, or even, you know, I mean, you can maybe pull some together for the 37th, you know, to sort of show us, particularly those members of the big band that are no longer with the band, you know, because they've died or because, you know, they got busy or for whatever reason. It'd be nice to sort of just see, like, oh, my God. That person was a part of the big band. Oh, and that person would be really nice to sort of get a history, you know, visually of the magnitude of the work that this All-Star Big Band has accomplished over these 37 years, as well as the impact on our current, you know, musical legacy. You know, this thing called jazz.
We're gonna put you in charge for helping put that together.
Oh, sure, no problem. 3 years. Yeah, that'll okay. Make sure you keep my number. Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining me to talk about, you know, this wonderful fundraiser and celebration of 37 years. And the CD release party is always great, you know, when there's something people can take home with them.
Yes, I want to make sure that people go to yoshis.com and get their advance tickets, because, of course, the night of the show, it's going to be about $5 more plus service fees. And then up and through the 8th of November, a group of 10 people can go online at yoshis.com and be able to use the code called G GROUP, which is group, in capital letters, and be able to get in for about half the price.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important if people have a group of 10.
Right, so that means it'll be $10 instead of 20 in advance.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then for 65 and over, it's 15 in advance. And
right.
And then students is 10 in advance. So everything is 5 less in advance.
Yeah. That's right, in advance. So we want the people to get advance tickets because, you know, it could very easily sell out, too. So
oh, yeah.
You don't want anybody to lose out, just like voting for tomorrow.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, and by the time, you know, the November 12th, we will know, you know, we will be assured of the next 4 years, you know?
You know what happened last year, or the last time we were this was 2009 when we first performed at Yoshi's with the big band.
Mm-hmm.
It was the night before President Obama's inauguration, believe it or not.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were celebrating big time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hope this time we can celebrate big time for Barack Obama to retain his office.
Yeah. You plan these celebrations strategically.
Yes, it seems like it.
Wow. Well, thank you again so much for joining me to talk about, you know, the upcoming celebration of the San Francisco All-Star Big Band that you are the fearless leader of. And, yeah, it'd be great, you know, to have, you know, celebrating a lot of things and just be celebrating the president's, you know, second term. That would be really super as well.
It would be. And I really appreciate you taking the time and energy and making this interview possible.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care.
All right, you too.
Bye. All right, bye-bye. Peace and blessings.
That was the San Francisco All-Star Big Band, one of the selections from their 37th anniversary CD, which is self-titled. And that particular piece was called Mini Skirts. And again, the fundraiser for the American Cancer Society and the CD release party, everything is happening on Monday, November 12th. It's also going to be a celebration of President Barack Obama's second term, and that's all happening on Monday at Yoshi's in San Francisco, 8 p.m., one show, two sets. And again, you heard Mr. Hardiman mentioning about the discounts. So today is the 9th, so day past that. What is it, 10 or more? You go on the line and do the group thing. But anyway, you can still get tickets in advance and still get a deal. If you get them in advance, you save $5. So we're going to just roll right into an interview, a pre-recorded interview with Della Reese, who is Tess in Touched by an Angel. And then we're going to close out with an interview with director Ava DuVernay about her latest feature, which is opening all around the country, closed in some places and opening in other places, and continuing its theatrical run, which is really awesome, this week. And the film is The Middle of Nowhere. So here's Della Reese.
Such an honor to speak to you. My
That's
goodness.
That's very sweet. I love you already.
Yeah, and just reading up on you know, sort of your extensive and long career, I guess, I don't know, growing up in the church and singing in the church and then coming full circle, because now you're a minister too, right?
Yes, and it is full circle.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's been a very pleasant journey.
Mm-hmm.
God has been very good to me.
Right.
Because it's impossible for me to have been and am where I am without the grace of God, because I had no lessons in music. I can't read music. I didn't have any connections. I didn't have a sponsor. Just God. All I had was God, and that was all I needed, and I succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then you've been you're so well known on a lot of different levels. I mean, you're a television star, you've had talk shows, what haven't you done?
Well, I hope there's something left, because I'm still alive. I hope it isn't over.
Right, yeah. So let's talk first about your wonderful exclusive engagement coming up here from L.A. to the Razz Room.
I haven't been to San Francisco mm-hmm. for a very long time. There was a time
mm-hmm.
when I first started, when I had hit records and things like that,
yeah.
that it was a part of the circuit that I played. I played San Diego, San Francisco, Los Angeles, because at that time I was working in Vegas. I was in Las Vegas for 9 years,
mm-hmm.
Vegas, Reno, and Tahoe. And so in between, rather than to go back to New York where I lived, I would come from Vegas to San Diego, or Vegas to San Francisco, or Reno to San Francisco, because it was all in the same sphere. So I worked here quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't been there for quite a while.
Right. Well, I'm sure you're going to sell out all three dates, you know, February 16th, 17th, and 18th. Oh, yeah, yeah. So are you bringing your own ensemble with you?
Yes, I'm bringing a trio.
Okay, okay. Yeah, and so are you going to just do like a medley of best ofs? Or?
No, it has a different connotation.
Mm-hmm.
I have, as you have just told me, I have done a lot of different things.
Yes.
And this is about my life in music, the things that I've done, the people that I had a chance to work with, the people I knew and was very good friends with, the people I've sung with, the shows I've done with people, and what I knew about those people and how they reacted to me and how I reacted to them, with music included.
Oh, okay. So it's going to be more theatrical.
It's going to be like you came to my house and we sat down and we talked about my life.
Oh, that's going to be so great. Are you going to do something different every evening, or is it going to be...
Well, I'm not going to tell that part. You don't get the punchline before you hear the joke.
Yeah, I was just looking at some of the great ladies of song that, you know, you came up under and alongside of, who are no longer with us. More recently, you know, we lost, you know, Etta James.
Yes, yes,
mm-hmm.
yes. I, as I said to you earlier, God has blessed me tremendously
mm-hmm.
in so many different ways that I want to share with my audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So talk about, you know, some of these great women of song that, that you know, you befriended and befriended you, and, you know, like Mahalia Jackson, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie
Holiday.
I'm going
to talk about all of them. I have things that we went through together, the friendships that we had together, the doors that we opened together, because there were a lot of places that black women weren't allowed, and we were allowed because of our talent, and we had a chance to open the doors for other people to come through also.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you have a lot of fans from Touched by an Angel.
Well, now that was really a marvelous experience, Wanda.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me a chance to really work in both of the professions that I have as a teacher, as a minister, and as an artist, an actress, a singer. All of it came together in one pot. Because the stories that I was doing were based on the fact that God is good. And the music that I was singing, some of it I wrote it, and some of it were songs that I chose because of what they said, and they wrote the script around the songs.
Nice.
So it worked. And then I was able to start the church that I have now and to be able to support it. And we really give a terrible blow to preachers take the money from the church to buy cars because I was making a good living and I already had a couple of cars, so I didn't have to take the church's money to buy a car. And it was very obvious and very evident that those were the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and then also I have people still today that I meet in the supermarket, in the ladies' room, or in the airport, that come over and ask me, when is the show coming back on? And it's been off for 6 years. And the fact that they still want to see it after it's been off for so long is very ingratiating to me.
Mm-hmm.
They come and they tell me that it's interesting because they never say this was just what I needed to hear. It was always for my cousin or my sister, the show that you did. My sister really needed to see that show. And it helped my sister or it helped my brother or my cousin or somebody. And they would tell, they stop and they tell me their situations and how they happened to, they all say the same thing. I don't know how I happened to be in the room watching the television, or I wasn't in the room watching the television. Somebody called me and said, come look at this. And it was just marvelous. It was just what I needed to see for my sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember watching it on Sundays, similar to when I was a kid coming up, we'd watch Ed Sullivan on Sundays. And it just... I just love the moral lessons and the whole idea that these angels, I mean, it really humanized everything. It's like it made it so accessible.
Yes.
You know, this whole spirituality and this whole realm. It's like it wasn't somewhere far away because you all, you know, flesh and blood interacting with these folks.
Absolutely. And that was one of the main points that appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tendency to put God on a cloud with a book across his lap and a pen, checking off all the wrong that we do and saying, I got you now, which is ridiculous because if God wanted you, one breath, and you'd be gone, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They have, most people present God without any humanity and no sense of humor, and he must have a sense of humor. Have you ever seen a platypus?
Mm.
If
yeah.
you just look at one,
mm-hmm.
then you know he must have been laughing all the while he was making that.
Mm-hmm.
Or orangutan.
Yeah.
He must have looked and said, I need something to laugh about today, so I'm going to make this.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that was the good thing about the show. It had to do with the humanity that God feels with us, that he appreciates us. And he said we're the greatest things he ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And that just that thought itself, of all the things that he has made, for him to say that we are the greatest things he's ever made. The cheetah is faster. The birds fly higher. The waters are deeper and vaster. And, you know, for him to pick us out and say, ooh, that made me feel good just talking about it.
Yeah, considering of all of the creation, we make the biggest mistakes.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Mm.
But to see that's why he installed forgiveness.
Mm.
You see, if we can forgive each other, he can forgive us. And he knows that we do things like that. He created us. So the dumb things we do are not a surprise to him.
That's true.
And he's more than willing for us to recognize that we have done a dumb thing and apologize. And forgive ourselves first. I recognize what I've done. I'm not going to do this anymore. I forgive me for making that mistake. But from this moment on, I'm going to do better in that category.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the New Thought, I guess, is that the ministry, New Thought?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It says ministry and the understanding principles of for Better Living Church.
Yeah, we call it Up Church because that's Up our intention, to think up, to
be
successful,
nice. Yeah.
To prosper,
mm-hmm.
to live in love, peace, joy, and happiness, all the good stuff.
Okay. Well, that's neat. So you're still, regularly ministering to...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, where is the church located in
Los Angeles?
We're at in Los Angeles.
What, the address you mean?
Well, like what part of Los Angeles is big?
Oh, let me tell you this. We've been all over Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
We started in my kitchen, 8 people around the kitchen table, and there became so many people coming to the classes that my husband couldn't go to the kitchen to get a glass of water without being fully dressed.
Hmm.
And wanting to keep my marriage happy, I thought, well, I'll get a place outside of the house,
uh-huh.
so that anybody who wants to come can come. So I started close to my house. I live in Bel Air.
Okay.
I started in West Hollywood. We were there for about 3 years in the ballroom of a hotel, and they sold the hotel to another entity, and they wanted to repair it, and so we moved further east. And we stayed there for 2 years, and I don't even remember what happened, but something did. And so then we moved, and finally we are now in Inglewood,
okay.
which is the first time we've had an opportunity for me to be with my people, because where I was living before, I had a mixed audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a mixed audience, but mixed more to my race of people than to the other race of people, races
mm-hmm.
of people.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. Yeah, just wondering about this sort of, you're talking about, your congregation changing as the geography changed with regards to where you all were housed. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, being a youngster, you and your mother, going to the movies and, and looking at the images that were on the screen, some of whom looked like you, most of them that didn't, and you're being such an image maker in your work. Your image, I'm sure, really inspired a lot of artists that you know, had known, you know, that a career in the media was possible.
I hope so, but I've got to tell you the truth. I did not start out to be the champion for my people. First of all, I needed to eat. I like eating. I like sleeping indoors. I like having nice things. And so I started to work for myself. And then my daughter was born. And I was a single parent. And so then I worked for the security of my family, my daughter and I. And along the way, God had the plan that I didn't see until I was a long ways up in life, that I had the privilege of him choosing me to open doors so that other people could come through. Now, I wish I could say that one morning when I was young, I woke up and said, I'm going to open the doors so that my people can get through. Well, that would be a lie. That was not. I was working to survive. But in my survival, I was put into places where I could open doors.
Right. Yeah. And I was just reading. I don't know how much of this is actually is true, but you know, as you were sort of coming up, you know, as an artist, you know, your family wasn't always, you know, tranquil. The relationships between, you know, yourself and your father and your mother passing on, you know, when, I guess, were you an adult when your mother made her transition?
I was 17 when my mother made her transition.
Okay, so you weren't
Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah, and...
But I had a very loving home. And my mother and my father were very different. My mother was a personal friend of God's. And my father was a marvelous man, but he thought all of that that she believed in was a waste. He was one of those people that says, you're buying the preacher's $1,500 suits and we can't pay the rent. And you bought him a car and we're catching a streetcar and of that nature. But what I learned there in that house was it is possible to love, if you have enough love, to put up with both sides of that and have a wonderful relationship, which is what they did. They loved each other very much. So I was raised up in the nest of love by two different people, if you can understand what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
And the benefit of both of them was very important. My mother, as I said, was a personal friend of God, so she took me along the road of knowing how and when and why and all of the things that had to do with having a personal relationship with God. And my father taught me how to laugh, how to tell jokes, how to be funny. So I, in that little place where we were together, I got both sides of a shiny coin.
Yeah, it says that, you know, you were raised in the Black Bottom neighborhood of Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah.
Your father, Richard Thaddeus Early, was a steel worker, and
he,
your mom...
He literally poured steel, Wanda.
Poured
and
steel?
And he poured, literally poured steel. Can you imagine how hot that is when you're...
No,
and,
I can't. Wow.
What was one of the things that first made me go, what, was he worked there for 37 years. And when they retired him, it was because he was over the retirement age. And when they retired him, they bought a machine because they said what he was doing was not the kind of work a man should do. It was too dangerous.
After 37 years.
37 years.
Wow, that is amazing. And then your mother, Nellie Michelle, she was a Native American, Cherokee.
Yes.
Yeah, and she worked as a cook.
Well, she, my mother was what the father created us for. My mother was a help meet. If you read your Bible, in Genesis it said that God said it was not good for Adam to be alone, And so he would create for him a help meet, and that's what my mother was.
Mm-hmm.
She helped my father meet the obstacles of living. She cooked, she scrubbed floors, she was a marvelous seamstress, so she sewed and repaired clothes. And we lived on Verna Highway, which is now a main part of the freeway. But at that time, it was the closest to the higher crust of people who had a lot of money. And the things that the women wore, the cleaning was done with such, not with the techniques that we have now. Dresses were ruined because the chemicals were too strong, and there are a lot of other reasons that we have no need to go through here.
Mm-hmm.
And they discovered my mother, who was wonderful at taking care of marvelous pieces of material. And so she did the cleaning of gowns and dresses for the rich people who lived in Grosse Pointe, who would send their chauffeurs with their things to my mother to be cleaned.
Hmm.
And she did all these things to help my father meet the needs of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was reading that you were the younger
I'm
child.
I'm the baby. I'm mm-hmm. not just the youngest. I'm the baby.
You're the baby, yeah. And you had your siblings were so much older than you that it was almost like you were an only child.
Married three times, and they were all grown except for my brother when I was born.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I read that, you know, you were such such a smart child that you graduated from high school, was at Cass Technical High School at 15?
No, Northeastern High School.
Oh, Northeastern. Oh, okay. Yeah.
But see, she recognized, my mother recognized that education was important. I'm thinking that she did recognize it because she only went through the third grade.
Mm-hmm.
But she was so intelligent
mm-hmm.
that you would have thought she graduated from Harvard.
Right.
Innately, she was intelligent. She could do so many things, and you don't know. I don't know why I said that. But she had all of these different things that she did to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my mother could cook this phone you're talking over, and you'd ask her for one more piece. You know, that kind of lady. She the people whose clothes she took care of didn't want anybody to touch them but her. She had a couple of people we lived in an apartment building, and there were a couple of people she cleaned their apartments, and they swore by it. Her work on all levels was just excellent. You see, I learned that from her. Whatever you're going to do, do it to the best of your ability. Don't let the name of it make you shirk the work.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And were you the first in your family to graduate from high school?
Absolutely. First one to go to school, first one to graduate from school. And before she died, I had 2 years in Wayne University, which was made her so proud. None of my family ever went that far.
Right, yeah. And I was reading that, you know, that you one of the reasons why you didn't finish at Wayne was because your father became ill.
Well, no, the reason I didn't finish was there was without my mother helping to meet, there was no money.
Oh.
You know, he made enough to pay the rent and buy food, but there was no extra money. My mother, the things that I've been telling you that she did was the money that, and her prayers was the money that was available for me to go to school and to go into college. But after that, there was no money for that.
Okay.
And there was nobody to take care of my father. My father couldn't boil water. She liked it that way. She didn't want him to do anything. He had the things that he would do, and she had the things that she would do. He had the things that he should do for her. She had the things she should do for him.
Mm-hmm.
So when she made her transition, he couldn't do anything. I mean, he just didn't know how to boil water. He didn't know how to, he had never had to do, they were married for 37 years, mm-hmm. and for 37 years she took care of everything that had to do with the house,
mm-hmm.
with taking care of him. So he was at a loss, so I had to come home to take care of him because there was nobody else to do that.
Yeah.
But it was good.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know him.
Okay.
You know, I got to know him.
Mm-hmm. So I noticed that some of the jobs, some of the odd jobs were truck driver, dental
yeah.
receptionist, elevator operator, similar
yeah.
to what
yeah.
Maya Angelou did when she, you know, was here in San Francisco raising her young son by herself. So when were you able to, so to speak, lead your own life?
Well, I think I always did lead my own life. I think that was, now, don't misunderstand me, there were rules and regulations
mm-hmm.
in my mother and father's house.
Uh-huh.
And you had to abide by them. But there was no rules and regulations about your desires and your ability to think
mm-hmm.
or your creativity. So I've always been who I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Although I've been different people at different stages of my life.
Uh-huh. Okay. So who are you now?
I don't know that I have a name for me. There's so much of me. There's all the things that I have done, so I know for sure I can do them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all the things I'm trying to get through before I go home to be with the Father. And so each day is exciting, trying something new. I didn't know I was going to talk to you today till today.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
right.
So the excitement of talking to you has made my day so far,
mm-hmm.
and it's early in the day yet.
Right. I was wondering if you could talk about maybe some of the other personas you've donned in your career. I really love seeing you with Red Fox.
That was my friend. He was my friend for 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was so misjudged.
Mm.
He was not his act.
Mm-hmm.
He was a giving. The reason Red didn't have any money was because he was a giver.
Mm-hmm.
If you went to him and said, I don't have any money, he would reach in his pocket and do something for you. For an example, I was in Vegas. This was many years ago. I was in Vegas, and I had finished my engagement, and I had been gambling, which I did not have to know how to do and had no business doing anyway. And I was down to my last, I don't remember how much, but it was the last of what was there. And I went to see him at a club, and he said, how are you doing? And I said, I'm doing fine. I've never been much for complaining. I said, I'm doing fine. He says, where are you working? I said, I'm not working. I'm going back home to New York. And he says, what do you mean you're going back? This is the main season. You ought to be here working so people can hear you. I said, well, I haven't had any offers. That was the whole conversation. So when his employer came in, the owner of the club, he says to the employer, I'm going to need some help there because I'm doing these three shows, and it's tiring to do all three of these shows. And Red was packing the place, so what he said made some sense to the owner. He said, I'm going to have to get some help. And so the owner said, well, I don't know who to get for you. He said, well, you're lucky because Della Reese is in town. And she can open for me.
Mm.
And right there in my face, he set up the schedule, how much time I would do, when I would work, all of that.
Mm.
And when the owner left to go out, I had a job. That I had not come in and said, please help me, I need a job. But he had been sensitive enough to know that I must have needed a job or I would have already been on the plane going home.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, my father loved Red Fox.
Red was the funniest man that ever walked the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Red was the type of person, Wanda, if you and I were standing on one side of the street and he was across the street and he started walking toward us, either you would say to me or I would say to you, look at it, here come Red. He hadn't done anything. He hadn't said anything.
Mm.
But the essence of him was so big that it would reach across the street and you would start laughing before he got there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have been around a lot of wonderful comedians. In the film Harlem Nights.
Yes.
Yeah, Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Arsenio.
Yeah, that was really something.
Mm-hmm.
All of them together. There.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
My sides hurt every day.
Mm.
The movie was good, but we did it here in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and we did it on a lot that was accessible. You know, by that I mean it wasn't out on the road or something. It was right in town,
mm-hmm.
and everybody wanted to be a part of the picture. And so what they should have recorded was the lot where the trailers were kept,
mm-hmm.
because everybody would come over and do an audition to be selected to be in the any kind of way in there,
mm-hmm.
Extra, a walk on, anything. So what I did was laugh all day long,
mm-hmm.
laughter from everywhere. It was a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we only have a few more minutes, and I had forgotten that you were at the Oprah Winfrey Legends Ball.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and I was just in Johannesburg in January for the 100th anniversary of the ANC, as well as Oprah Winfrey. I didn't get a chance to go, but her girls, this is the
yes.
first graduating class.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could maybe share with us, sort of what it means to be a legend. And
well, I can't really share that with you because I never think about myself as that.
Mm.
I never think about, oh, look at me. You know,
mm-hmm.
I really feel like whatever magnificent thing I was meant to do, I haven't done it yet.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not very good at counting my laurels.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy with what I have done. I appreciate what I have done. I'm blessed to have done what I have done. But the good thing, the good is good thing, good is good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've done it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sitting down on it. I'm still working at it.
Right, right. Yeah. You've your life sort of signifies, being able to work through some pretty, devastating sometimes, trauma. And I'm looking at, what happened with your daughter. And then, as a type 2 diabetes, I don't know if you still have it, but, someone that has that.
It's attacking my body, but I'm winning.
Yeah, exactly. And I was wondering if you could maybe, in our closing moments, maybe sort of share a couple of things that you've learned that maybe you're going to be telling us in the show that you're going to be doing at the Razz Room, but maybe
you can I want you to come and see the show and hear the show and be a part of it. I want us to be together,
mm-hmm.
and I want to look at your face when I tell you, and I want you to look at mine when I tell you.
Okay, all right. Well, something that's not from the show, but I was wondering if you have any sort of closing words of wisdom that. Because, we're getting ready. We have our first black president. He is completing his first term. This is an election year. There are a lot of people that are not doing really well in America, and a lot of people that are doing really well throughout the world. Yet, without the kind of light artists, like yourself shine, to give people hope, people might not even get up the next day. And I'm just wondering if you had something that you could share with our audience words of wisdom.
I don't know. What I can just tell you about what I do.
Yes.
What I do is trust God. I absolutely trust God.
Mm.
I believe that Christ did come to save me, and I believe that a piece of God lives inside of me. So whatever it is that I'm confronted with, this has nothing to do with egotism, I feel like I am the victor. And I operate from the point of feeling like I am the victor. Now, that don't mean I don't get knocked down sometimes, but I know, I understand it doesn't matter how many times you get knocked down. What's important is how many times you get up.
Right.
You see? Mm-hmm. And so that's the platform that I operate from. And so whatever is coming, whatever I have to, since I've been through it, see, that's where my past helps a lot. I've been through so many things already. You see, there's nothing frightening. My brain exploded, and I'm still here. When they kept telling me every day I was going to die, I walked through a plate glass window. I lost 7 pints of blood. I didn't have but 9. And I succeeded. So whatever is coming, especially on the human level, is not as bad as brain surgery, which I had twice and succeeded. It's not as bad as losing all of my blood except 2 pints, which I've already successfully lived through. All of this happened years ago, and I'm still here. So I have the attitude of the victory, you see. Now, sometimes I have to fight it, and I fight it with my trust in God, my faith in God, my inner strength, knowing that God loves me and lives inside of me. So I come from that point of view. Mm-hmm. I found out if I change my mind, I change my life. So I'm in a habit of changing my mind. Stop thinking about how bad it is, and I think about how good it is. And I think about this is not only going to be here for a minute, and I'm on the way to great, great, greater great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you. I was at a concert and there was a song, and I can't remember the name of the artist who sang it. You would know him if I could remember his name, but I can't right at the moment. But he said that there's a song that he loves. I think he and his wife love. And he says, you know, we fall down,
but we get up. Absolutely, positively.
Yeah, and I thought that was a great affirmation. It's like, so I never forgot that. I was like, and when you said this, like, yeah, you know, things might knock you down, but you get right back on up.
And I've learned this, Wanda. Mm-hmm. There are some things that you only learn when you go through a crisis.
Hmm.
You see, and once you know that every crisis is not the end of the world, you see, that I'm here for a reason. I'm supposed to learn. Let me get what I'm supposed to get out of this so I don't ever have to do this again.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Am I going to get a chance to hold you in my arms at all?
Oh, yes. I am going to come see you, definitely.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
But thank you so much for the wonderful conversation, and have a safe journey this way.
God bless you and keep you.
All right, God bless you too.
Kisses all over your body.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was the end of Michael White's The Land of Spirit and Light, Part 1. And I'm trying to decide, I'm kind of torn, should I play The Land of Spirit and Light, Part 2 and Part 3, or should I play Ava DuVernay's interview so you can hear that, because that was really phenomenal. And as I mentioned, her film, The Middle of Nowhere, is opening all over the country and is actually playing in many theaters throughout the country, right here in New Orleans, where I am presently, at the Zygist Studios. So anyway, it was really great interviewing Michael White and his wife, and they live in Southern California. And they came up and they, for this past year's Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival that's put on by Eastside Arts Alliance. And it was a tribute to wonderful, wonderful violinist Billy Bang. And that was just really a fabulous concert. And Mazeki Roperson was a part of that. He was playing piano. And Mazeki Roperson has a concert this weekend at the 57th Street Gallery in North Oakland. So you want to catch that. I believe it's on Saturday night, which is tomorrow, the 10th. And so that should be exciting. Mazeki is always fantastic. So as I chat and think about it, I think I'm going to go ahead and play another part of this Land of Spirit and Light, Part 2, and maybe I'll close the show with Part 3 and maybe give you a little Ava DuVernay. Or maybe I'm trying to think, God, it's like, this Gemini thing sometimes gets the best of me, being indecisive, that is. So anyway, Land of Spirit and Light, Part 2. Thank you.
Well, that was Spirit and Light Part 3, so you notice that I played all three of them. And so we're going to close with Ava DuVernay talking about her latest feature, Middle of Nowhere. And if there's more time after that, because we're going into the after show, Amara Tabor-Smith is going to talk about Our Daily Bread, which is coming back to CounterPulse. I'm trying to think, when is it opening? I think it's opening in a week. We had a great interview talking about Our Daily Bread, the Our Daily Bread movement, looking at our food, looking how food brings us together for conversation and activism. And this weekend is also, I think it's the Green Fest in San Francisco. So there's a whole lot of great things going on. I'm not certain what's going on here in New Orleans besides the middle of nowhere. However, New Orleans is a happening place. So I'm sure there's a whole lot going on, and I got to check out and see what I can get into later on today after the show. But we're going to close again with Ava DuVernay and Amara Tabor-Smith if we have enough time. And I hope everyone has a great weekend. Peace and blessings.
Good afternoon and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are going to be joined by, or we might be joined by, Oh, I think we lost her. We have to call her back. We're joined in the studio by Ava DuVernay, who is the director, writer, and producer of the wonderful film, The Middle of Nowhere, which is actually going to be opening on the 2nd of November at in Stonestown in San Francisco. So we're going to play a little bit of music while we get her back in the studio. And we're going to play we're going to play a little bit of Amakayla's Being in Love from her Being in Love CD, Lovely Day, by Bill Withers. Is that you?
Yes, it is.
Oh, excellent. Because I was like, oh, let me call her back. We lost her.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm so happy you could fit us into your schedule to talk about your wonderful film, Middle of Nowhere, that's opening up all over the country. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for fitting me in.
Oh, it is. Oh, I've been, like, waiting. It's like, when I first read about it, I'm like, oh, my God. This is because I really enjoyed your first feature and your other films that you've done. I mean, you produce some really wonderful work.
Oh, I appreciate
really,
it.
Very top-notch. And then when I was reading, this was supposed to be a low-budget film. Like, really? I mean, it's just so beautiful from the cinematography to the story to the fine cast. I mean, no wonder you got Best Director at Sundance.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem. Let me read a little bit of your bio, and then we can talk about your film. You're making your feature directorial debut. You made your featured directorial debut with a critically acclaimed 2008 hip hop documentary, This Is the Life. That was really great. Winner of the Audience Awards in Toronto, Los Angeles, and Seattle. We were so happy that you all could come up yourself and some of the poets and other folks from the Good Life Cafe, sort of really like cultural mecca there in LA. That you documented in your wonderful film. We're so happy you came up to Oakland as a part of the San Francisco Black Film Festival when Ava was still around and with us. That was just really, really special.
Yeah, it was a really great screening that night. So
mm-hmm.
cool.
Yeah, yeah. And then in 2010, you wrote and produced and directed the narrative feature I Will Follow, starring Sally Richardson Whitfield. And then it was released theatrically in 2011. And once again, you know, centered around sort of like the independent media circuit, and have some great screenings up here in Northern California. And once again, you know, really wonderful film about how family handles loss, you know, and dying. And and again, you know, sort of these topics that you touch in both I Will Follow and now in Middle of Nowhere are topics that, you know, people don't necessarily want to talk about.
Right, right. No, absolutely. It's, you know, I think it's important to kind of explore the places that we don't often see on screen, and especially with people of color and women. And so, yeah, definitely something that I'm interested in, and I'm just fortunate to have the opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And the last time we spoke, you were telling me about Faith Through the Storm, the documentary about black women Katrina survivors, which aired on BET and TV One, and I'm still looking for it because I really want to see it.
Yeah, hey, that's property of TV One, so they air it every now and then. But it was a great project, and I was so happy to be able to shine a light on some of the really amazing women we met in the region.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And you're a UCLA graduate and the founder of AFFIRM, the African American Film Festival Releasing Movement, and you're a member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and you're based in Los Angeles. And I was speaking to Charles Burnett, and because L.A. Rebellion was a part of the L.A. Standard exhibit, which was multimedia film, you know, visual arts, et cetera, in Los Angeles. And now L.A. Rebellion, looking at those filmmakers coming out of the film and television program at UCLA, it's up here in Northern California, UC Berkeley, and it closes this evening, and it's been up here since September, the end of September, and we've been watching some wonderful films. And he said that, well, he, you know, he knew you, and he thought you were really fabulous. And he said that you came through that UCLA as well.
Yes, I'm a UCLA alumni, but not in the film school.
Right.
Charles and Haile Garima and Julie Dash were all a part of the film school there. I didn't know that I wanted to be a filmmaker at the time that I was at UCLA, but UCLA has a very rich black student history, which I was really honored to be a part of. It was such an amazing legacy of just icons that have gone through the university overall, and the black community is very connected, at least it was anyway when I was there, to what had happened in the past, particularly in the 60s and 70s. And so, yes, I wasn't through the film school, but definitely the same university, and feel really connected to the whole L.A. Rebellion. It's a beautiful exhibit. Beautiful program that was put together, and a lot of us filmmakers out here were there every night watching the various films, and then there's an art exhibit that goes with it, and
mm-hmm.
just a gorgeous, gorgeous exhibition.
Right, yeah.
I hope people had a chance to check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
yeah.
I'm really happy that, you know, at least the film portion of it, you know, did travel, and you know, Pacific Film Archive here at UC Berkeley, you know, put in a bid and got it up here. So it's been really great, you know, seeing the films on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and sometimes Sunday evenings. It's just been really great. And sometimes the directors the camera people who were able to come up and engage us in conversation. So it's been really great.
Mm-hmm.
So if you didn't know you wanted to be a director at that time, what were you studying, and how did you decide to make films?
Yeah, I was a double major, English Literature and African American Studies.
Mm-hmm.
I was definitely, you know, interested in film as a consumer at that time. I've always been a big film lover, but at the time didn't have any designs on being a filmmaker. I knew I wanted to work around film, so I immediately got into film publicity. Eventually started my own agency after working at a couple of studios. Founded the DuVernay Agency in 1999, and we worked on, you know, an amazing array of projects, film, television, corporate brands, everything from Dreamgirls to Invictus to The Help to Girlfriends, the TV show to AOL, Blockbuster. We did a lot of great work over the 12-year period, and somewhere along that time, I just got the filmmaking bug. I think it was just proximity to great directors and
mm-hmm.
being on so many sets. I started to feel like I had a story to tell, so I started dabbling making shorts, and then my doc, This Is a Life, and then I was commissioned to do a couple of docs for some networks like TV1 and BET,
mm-hmm.
And eventually made my first feature, I Will Follow, from my savings.
Yeah.
And the success of that allowed my producing partner, Howard, and I to go out and raise money for Middle of Nowhere, which is out now.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I think it's just so amazing the way you have these company names, that the acronym is an affirmation. Affirm, African American Film Festival Releasing Movement. Affirm, like, you know, that's like, you know, every time you say it, you are sort of saying an ashe to whatever you're doing.
right, absolutely.
Yeah, and then you got Forward Movement, like, wow, your production.
Yeah.
Forward
yeah.
Movement, like, wow, it's like, that's also something that's, it's not static. You know,
right.
You're constantly evolving and getting better, and I was like, wow, that is just so cool.
Oh, well, thank you. You're the first person to notice that, so I appreciate it.
Oh, well, yeah. So tell us about this great story that you're telling in Middle of Nowhere. I mean, the whole idea, that's so visual, Middle of Nowhere.
Right.
To be nowhere is one thing, but then be the middle of that place? Wow.
Right. Yeah, no, it's it is a love story, a real complicated love story about a sister named Ruby who's, you know, married to the love of her life, and he's unexpectedly incarcerated. She's in medical school. She had no idea that he was involved in any kind of activity that might get him behind bars. But when he is sentenced, she has to make a decision whether or not to stay with him or move on, and she decides to stay with him. And so the film chronicles her, you know, journey to support him from beyond bars, you know, her crisis of identity in that situation, kind of the challenges of you know, everything from finances to familial relationships to, you know, just her own issues of self-worth. And so, you know, through that process, it's all wrapped in this love story. But you are really getting glimpses of, you know, what life is like for the millions and millions of loved ones of incarcerated people.
Mm-hmm. Right. And actually, you wrote the story or the screenplay, and then you sort of put it up for a while, and did some other things. So you talk about the epidemic of incarceration, and in your film, you know, you show how incarceration not just affects the person who's behind bars, but it affects, you know, everyone that's connected to that person. And in this case, you know, Ruby, you know, the wife of Derek, who is inside, and as she's evolving and changing, we're not certain because there are aspects of his life that she wasn't privy to, and so, but he has to adjust as well to this environment because there are certain things one has to do when one is in custody and incarcerated and doesn't have certain kind of freedoms. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, the story. And you also mentioned in what I was reading that you actually used to see women getting up early, taking that bus trip somewhere early in the morning. And you've actually interviewed some women who have loved ones behind bars.
Yes. Well, we're really excited to be bringing this film to the Bay Area this weekend, debuting in San Francisco proper at the Stonestown Twin in South San Francisco, and we've been playing for a couple of weeks now at the Landmark Shattuck in Berkeley.
Right.
And yeah, you know, the film, you know, is really kind of delves into the lives of what I call women in waiting, you know, mothers, sisters, daughters, wives who, you know, are waiting for their incarcerated loved ones. I interviewed over 120 women for the script as I was fashioning the story, just to make sure that we, you know, were truthful and honest about what they go through, and really trying to find what the commonalities are amongst all of these different women who come from various backgrounds, cultures, ages, lifestyles. You know, the one thing that they all have in common is a real fierce loyalty, a patience, and, you know, a conviction a foundation for the relationship that they're fighting for and maintaining. So that's really what we focused on in the story, and just to give some humanity to these women who are so often slighted in cinema and in literature and just are not illustrated in the the media around the prison industrial complex. So it was really an honor to be able to, at least try to start having some conversation in film about them. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this, opens up and encourages other artists to look at this community a little bit more.
Right, right. And you're a native of Compton, California. So I was wondering if you could talk about where the film is shot and how, a native of Compton means that, you're from the hood. I mean, you know this story insofar as you might have, friends or you might have had classmates that were actually, living this particular story. And I was wondering about if you could talk about the movement from idea to screen, because it wasn't the kind of story that necessarily you found a lot of people interested in producing. And so your production team, you had relationships with the various people that, worked on the production, like Howard Barish, and your director of photography and your producer and your editor, and even your co-producer. Everyone, you already had a relationship. You didn't have to, develop it. And some people had actually read the screenplay years before and remembered it. If you could talk sort of like walk us from taking the script off the shelf and how did you know it was ready? and sort of finding your way through, actually producing it and then having the marvelous cast that you have that actually are breathing life into what could have been a real static situation, because the script itself is not static in that, we can't imagine things, but when you put it on the screen, you have to have people that are living this truth.
Right. Wow, that's a big question. I only have about 5 minutes, so I'm going to do my best. I'm going to do my best in this 5 minutes to answer. But, I appreciate the question. The evolution of a film is like, birthing a new life. It really is. These films are forever. They really are, what we want to leave behind as artists, and we want to make sure that we're being very intentional about what we're capturing and what we're creating and being responsible to, the community at large, but then also being true to the story that we want to tell. So, in doing that, I really go about it like, putting together a family. So I need like-minded people. And fortunately, this is my fifth film. And along the way on each film, I've met and cultivated relationships with people who are like-minded and who are interested in making the same kinds of things in the same kind of way. We don't work with a lot of money, so we need a lot of passion and elbow grease. And support from each other. So yeah, Howard Barish is my producing partner on I Will Follow and Middle of Nowhere. And he's, been incredibly supportive. He has a production company, I have a production company, and together, we've produced these films. On the first film I brought the money, on the second film he brought the money. And so it's worked out really, really nicely. On Middle of Nowhere we also brought in a good old friend of mine, Paul Garnes, who is a very prolific producer, has produced a bunch of stuff for T.D. Jakes and Tyler Perry Studios and BET. He is kind of the working producer who can make anything happen on any amount of money. He's really amazing. And he and Tulane Jones, who heads Forward Movement and Affirm, the three of them were the producers along with myself. Bradford Young, our director of photography, is a cinematographer who I love and had worked with before on My Mic Sounds Nice, African-American cinematographer and a good friend. So that was a natural relationship. I think probably my longest relationship with anyone in our film family is Spencer Averick, my editor. He's edited every single thing I've ever made, from the first documentary, This Is the Life, to My Mic Sounds Nice, to Faith Through the Storm, to my stuff on Black Girls Rock, to I Will Follow, to any commercial work that I do. It always ends up Spencer and I sitting in the dark trying to get it together. So, you know, Morgan Rhodes is our music supervisor, amazing sister, Catherine Bostick, amazing black woman composer, really trying to bring in, you know, Vonda Morris, this amazing woman who headed up the hair and makeup department and actually did both hair and makeup on every single cast member herself. She had only one person with her in her department. She basically did the whole movie single-handed. And that's what you have to do when you're working with a small amount of money. The whole film was shot in 19 days. So yeah, the cast came together in a really wonderful way. Omari Hardwick, I'd worked with before on I Will Follow, and it was a friend, and so had him in mind for the part, asked him if he wanted to come out and play with us. Of course, he said, and it was a great time. Imiasi Corinaldi, the lead, came in to me through the audition process. She had originally auditioned for another part. Our casting director, Aisha Coley, who's another just a longtime person that I've collaborated with, said, Ava, I think she might be a Ruby. So I saw her. I thought she was amazing, was blown away by the talent that had been kind of untapped and undiscovered in her. And so she was our lead. And then David Oyelowo actually came to the project through a really amazing miracle. He was on a plane sitting next to one of our investors in first class. David was on his way to do Looping on Planet of the Apes, a film that he was in last year. The investor was on his way back to his home in Toronto. They struck up a conversation. The investor said, yeah, a friend of mine, Howard Barish, wants me to invest in this film. David's like, what's the film? He says, it's actually a black independent film. David's like, well, what is it called? They have the exchange. My name is mentioned. David says, I just saw her on CNN for a film I Will Follow. I'd love to read it. Investor gives him the script. The next day, David calls me out of the blue and says, your phone number was on the script. I hope you don't mind that I called. I said, of course not. You're amazing. He says, I love the script. If there's any way I can be involved, I would love to. And he was, you know, signed and attached a week later. He was the first cast member on board. So, you know, with where the film is going, you know, organic kind of miracles and beautiful things start to happen. And the goal is to just work with people who you really like, who you feel comfortable with. And just as a director, make sure everyone's on the same page.
Wow. So talk about the three women. We've got Ruby, and we've got Rosie, and then we've got their mom, and she's also in our lane, right? Ruth.
Yes.
Which is really biblical. Was that intentional?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything's intentional.
Okay.
But, yeah, unfortunately, I just have about five more minutes. It was really important, the familial relationship between these women. I really envisioned a family of women and, you know, just kind of these really complex relationships between mothers and daughters and specifically black mothers and daughters who are adults. You know, to have three black women in a room is already a complicated endeavor. Then you add these familiar relationships and these expectations and these hopes and dreams that have been dashed, and it becomes a stew of you know, just really incredible experiences to try to illustrate cinematically. And I've been really pleased that so many sisters have, you know, come up to me or tweeted me and told me how much those scenes resonated with them. Even non-black women, you know, men who tell me that their favorite scenes are the ones between the mother and the sisters. Lorraine Toussaint is an amazing actor, a veteran actor who we were just fortunate accepted my humble offer to come play with us for a few days. And Edwina Finley plays a sister, an incredible young actress, who people may know from The Wire, and Tremé, who is just so great as Rosie. So it was really, you know, a beautiful cast, and people came to the project with, you know, open hearts and really beautiful spirits, and it was a good time.
Yeah, these characters you have, particularly the three women, they're not, you know, they're not canned. These women, you know, Ruby is, she's brilliant. She was in medical school. Her sister is a single mother, you know, trying to, she hasn't been really successful in relationships, but she's trying to support her son. And then the mother, she's really successful. I mean, really, really successful. But there's a fracture in the relationship between the mother and her daughters, and we're not quite certain what happens. And you sort of like, you know, keep the suspense there.
Yeah. You know, I'm really interested in not being so on the nose, doling out all the information. I think, you know, ultimately I drop you in the middle of these relationships and you get a glimpse into their lives. You know, if I walked into you know, your life right now, I wouldn't know all the intricacies of the relationships, but I think it would probably be fascinating to hear you talk to people that you knew and just to get a glimpse of, you know, of you. I think every person has some kind of story that's fascinating and some kind of narrative in their life that connects us to each other. And so that was the idea with that. So, yeah, I definitely resisted kind of giving you all the information and painting a perfect picture, but tried to leave it with open spaces so that people could breathe a little and bring some of themselves to the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just thinking of the way that Bradford shot the film, Bradford Young. It's we're really up close and really personal with the cinema. The way he has, you know, the really tight shots and the really close frames of Ruby and the family. I mean, it's really close. But within that closeness, there's also distance. So it's kind of like a juxtaposition, you know, the physical closeness, but we're not really close. So it's kind of interesting, that metaphor that gets played out often within the film. And I know you have to go, so I was wondering if maybe I'll give you two choices of things I'm interested in. The music is just really beautiful. And then I don't think you answered my question about where you shot. But then the one that I'm really interested in, that's okay, because I can read that somewhere. That's easy for me to find an answer. And then the third one, which I think maybe might be most exciting to my audience, is if you could tell us about the Sundance moment and what it's like to go to Sundance and to get, you know, the best director for 2012. I mean, if that's what you call the award. But anyway, you were, you know, like out of all the directors, you got the award for this particular year.
Right.
Like, wow, that's amazing.
Right. Well, thank you. No, I'll try to do all three. The music is all stuff that I really love. I had handled all the music supervision myself on the first film, I Will Follow. On the second film, you know, I reached out to a wonderful DJ, on-air personality here in Los Angeles that has a very, very late night show on one of our public radio stations called The Listening Station. Her name is Morgan Rhodes. And I asked her, I love the stuff she plays, and I asked her if she might be interested in working with me on it. She had mentioned that she was always interested in music supervision, so it was just something that we did together, picking music, listening to music. She brought me a lot of really beautiful things and helped me kind of navigate what I wanted to have but couldn't get my hands on. So between her selections of specific songs and amazing independent black artists like Michelle and Daguiocello and Little Dragon and Guapole and Jimmy James and Fink and Catherine Bostick, who's a black woman composer and did all of the score, and just the beautiful strings and the beautiful, very nuanced music that matches, you know, beat for beat all of the very emotional scenes. Between the two of them, it was just this amazing black woman music team, and we've got an amazing response to the music, so I'm just thrilled with that. They're like the stars now of the production. Everyone always asks about the music, and I love that. In terms of where we shot in South Central and in East L.A. and in the high deserts of California where, you know, the prisons are actually located, Lancaster, Victorville. Mm-hmm. And as far as the Sundance moment, you know, it was a complete thrill to even make it into Sundance. I had applied before and was rejected. I applied to the labs and was rejected. I applied with Shorts and was rejected. I applied with Docs and was rejected. I applied with I Will Follow. No, I actually didn't apply with I Will Follow. And I was just kind of like, you know what, this is just not for me. And finally, and I was just really kind of heartbroken at all of those that put a lot of stock in it. And so at the one point where I submitted it and kind of was like, okay, well, if they take it, they take it. If they don't, you know, I know this film will have a life because I had proven that it can still have a beautiful life with I Will Follow, is the one time that I got in.
Nice.
I didn't expect even to, you know, they have all these categories. And we were kind of in the top category, which is called dramatic competition. So that was another big thing. And then within dramatic competition, we were nominated for the grand jury prize, which is another big thing, and then had no idea that there was, you know, any kind of award in our future at all. Sitting at the award show, I was actually eating something when they called my name. I was so not even focused, like not even thinking was a possibility. I was about to take a bite when I heard my name. I was like, what did somebody, what category is this? Like, not even focused, because not thinking that, you know, I was just, it's a long show, and so, you know, I started to eat and, you know, kind of enjoy myself and found myself on stage. It was a beautiful moment, and, you know, more than anything else, it was something that's really given a beautiful light on our film. It's forced people, I think, to take a look at something that they might have overlooked and not taken a look at, so it's made people curious. And I certainly know within that, you know, because I'm the first black woman to win Best Director at Sundance, that I'm not the first black woman to deserve to win Best Director at Sundance. There were and have been a lot of amazing sisters that have gone through Sundance, from Gina Prince Bythewood to Dee Reese to Leslie Harris to Julie Dash. So, you know, for whatever reason, it was the time that it was given, and I'm happy to have it, but definitely acknowledging all the sisters who came before me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really generous of you, and it's just so wonderful that you would win Best Director, and you're telling one of our stories.
Thank you.
You know, and that's just so wonderful, and all of your stories are our stories, and it's just so great, and it's really wonderful speaking to you, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Good luck on everything, and I'm going to get a group of folks together to go check out your film over in San Francisco.
Yay, I appreciate it. I just want to thank you so much for the ongoing support. I see your name on every film that we're promoting, and not even just mine, the ones that we promote through Affirm, the African American Film Festival Releasing Movement. You've been really supportive, and we can't function if we don't have our press, you know, women, you know, black folk, you know, pushing for us. So I just want to say thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. And good luck on your next film.
All right. I'll be back. Thank
Take
you.
Care. You're
okay.
Welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So once again, we were speaking to director Ava DuVernay about Middle of Nowhere. And again, her film is opening, it's closing at the Shattuck in Berkeley, and it's opening on November 2nd in San Francisco exclusively at the UA Stonestown, United Artists Stonestown. So spread the word and get out and see this wonderful, wonderful film about this young woman. Who is married to a man who is incarcerated, and how that impacts her life as well as the lives of those who love her, like her mother and her sister and her nephew. And it's really, really a beautiful film, and it's really well shot, and it's a great, great story that Ava shares with us in this film. So we are waiting for our next guest to join us. And while we do that, I think I'm going to maybe play a little bit more of this. Maybe I'll play Hambone.
Go Queen Linda.
Hambone away, bitch, round the corner and back again.
Mm-hmm.
Hambone where you are.
Oh, yeah.
In the kitchen cooking rice.
Hambone.
Give me hambone. Give me some
hambone.
Well now, hambone, put him on your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a pretty girl, I'll show you how to hold her.
Mm-hmm.
Hambone, where you been all around the world and back again.
Hambone, what you gonna
well,
do? Got in a train and my fella flew.
Come
said, Hambone, where did you
yeah,
go?
Yeah.
I took Miss Lucy's
I tell door.
Miss Lucy, would you marry me? Well, I don't care if, how about I don't care?
Ha!
Play that.
Hamble, heavy hand. Mama gonna buy me a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't sing, mama gonna buy me a diamond ring. And if that diamond ring don't shine, mama gonna buy me a sister wine. And if that sister wine get broke, mama gonna buy me a billy door. But if that billy don't go wrong, mama gonna buy me a billy gun. And if that billy gun don't shoot, mama gonna buy me a swimming suit. But if some water get on me, mama gonna whip my baby feet.
Well, our guest hasn't joined us yet, so let me play something else while I try to see if Amara is going to be able to join us. I know she was in a rehearsal, but I just wanted to let folks know that Amara Tupper Smith's Deep Waters Dance Theater is bringing back Our Daily Bread to Counterpulse, and Our Daily Bread has become a movement of, you know, having these gatherings where people share food and conversation. And so it's going to be back November 15th through 18th at Counterpost 1310 Mission Street at Ninth in San Francisco. And if you missed it, you don't want to miss it this time, because it's a really wonderful, wonderful evening of dance. There are many, many companies that Amara is collaborating with for this particular piece, directed by Ellen Sebastian Chang, with visual artist Laura Diamondstone. It's just really beautiful. Our Daily Bread delivers a thoughtful message and a powerful experience. And there's live music, Ajaye Jackson and Guy De Chalice, costumes by Dana Kawano, and again, these wonderful, wonderful dance performers. And it's just, it's a real beautiful journey, and we eat. We actually feed us during this performance, which is really cool. So let me play something else from Michaela, who actually has a concert this coming month, November, and I'll let you know in a little bit what time that is going to be happening. And, oh, by the way, at the Oakland Public Conservatory of Music, there's going to be an inauguration of the Ed Kelly This is with the Ed Kelly studio, not studio, Ed Kelly room. I'm trying to get the language together. And there's going to be a special concert honoring Ed Kelly, wonderful teacher and musician and artist who gave a lot to the Oakland and larger community. And James Gales has just completed a beautiful painting of him. That's going to be hung in the Oakland Public Conservatory, and Michelle Rosewoman is going to be
in town. Actually, I think she's in town now, and she's going to be doing a special concert. And then prior to that, there's going to be a tour of African-American-owned galleries. So that's going to start a couple of hours before the concert, which I believe is at 7 or 7:30. And then people are going to jump in the van and tour the galleries and have some conversation about black art and culture, facilitated by Duane Ditterville, and then get back to Oakland Public Conservatory for the great concert featuring, again, Michelle Rosewoman, who actually was one of Ed Kelly's students, and she sees him as her mentor. And we were hoping to be able to maybe get her in an interview, but I'm not certain if that's going to happen because everyone is just so busy. And so anyway, I'm going to play another song by Michaela and see if we're going to be joined by Amara. So let's find out. Let's see. Maybe I'll play, so we're talking about Angela Wellman. Well, that's a long song. Maybe we'll end with that one. So we're going to start. We're going to play The Lovely Day That I Started But We Didn't Finish by Bill Withers. And again, it's on Michaela, and it's from her CD, Being in Love. Thank you.
gave me my truest love, and on this day and evermore I give myself completely to you.
I've been joined in the studio by Amar. I've been telling you all about her, and here she is, all frazzled, running around, moving cars and carrying around equipment and finishing up rehearsals right at the time she has to talk to us. So anyway,
yes. My apologies.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad you could still, find the mind space to join us and talk about your wonderful program that, it has become like an institution. Our Daily Bread is like, now it's, the project is a movement.
It feels like it. It definitely feels like it, of some sorts. And I take movements very seriously, especially towards change. So I say it's small, but, we've been committed. So,
So tell us about Our Daily Bread. You're a choreographer and a dancer and a teacher, and yet you're cooking. And I was telling our audience that you also feed us. We eat really yummy things too. At the performance, like you're actually really cooking. There's a kitchen for real that the dancers are coming in and out of.
Well, I can give you a little history on the piece. The piece was inspired by a conversation that I had with my mother about gumbo. Gumbos are a tradition in my family and something that I hold very dear and sacred. And my mother used to make gumbo for me every year on my birthday, and I don't really eat gumbo anymore because I don't eat seafood anymore for various reasons, some of them environmental, some of them connected to health. But I could never sort of acknowledged that I would never eat gumbo again. That was just, gumbo was exempt from that, except for that I wasn't really eating my mother's gumbo anymore, and she wasn't making it that often. And so we were talking about it, and I said, well, you know, what does it mean to have a food tradition or carry on a food tradition that you don't eat anymore? Or how do you keep that tradition going somehow, even though it might not be something that you partake in? You know, it was a big, broad question about, do we hold on to these things or do we let go of them? And so I started thinking about, well, why is gumbo so important to me? What is it? You know, my mother makes a lot of different things. But what I realized when I really went in depth asking that question of myself and talking to my mom is that it's what connects me to my Louisiana heritage. My mother's people, are both of her parents are from Louisiana, but she actually was born in Los Angeles. And then I was born in the Bay Area. I was born in San Francisco. And gumbo is really what connects me to my roots in Louisiana. And so I started on this quest to talk to other people about their food traditions, what was the food that they grew up eating. And at the same time, I wanted to deal with issues around our food systems and what's not working about them, and what needs to change, and thinking about ways to both educate people in the process but also stay to what really drives people around food, which is being nurtured and food being synonymous with love, really. So that was those were the seeds for the piece. And so I began interviewing lots of different people about food and having food parties and having gatherings that were around food. And I love to cook, and I've been told I'm a pretty good cook, and it's something that I feel really at home doing, more so than interviewing people. So I thought, let me just get some people together and let's eat and talk while we eat. Mm-hmm. And that's really where that movement came from, was out of those food parties. So these gatherings around food, we started to have different themes and topics that were food related that we would focus on, whether it was, what are your food traditions? What are you holding on to or letting go of? What ways are you changing food traditions that may no longer be healthy or sustainable? How are people being able to cook at home and eat, home-cooked meals on a regular basis, or how are they not able to do it and why? So there were various topics, urban gardening are just a few of the topics that we have explored. And, of course, once you start people talking about food, they'll tell you everything. So no matter what the topic is, sometimes that topic would stray, and that was fine. It was really about gathering people together to eat, because it's not something we do. I mean, we do it in restaurants, but in a setting of, a potluck, bring a dish that you cooked and share it with maybe some people you don't know, that was something that many people hadn't really done before. And became, a really important part of the development of this work that's called Our Daily Bread, mm-hmm. and has continued beyond the performance work. We've been continuing to do these food parties and continuing to collect stories and continuing to evolve this dance theater work that keeps changing, every time we do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how does one find out about this ongoing food discussion parties? Because I didn't know that they continued past the actual performance last year.
So I'm not very good at self-promotion. But what I did do is, one, the theater that has really invested in this show the past two and a 3 years that I've been working on it has been Counterpulse Theater in San Francisco, and they posted blogs that I wrote about this food journey. They also posted the schedule on their website of the different food parties. I also did Facebook. That was my main sort of get the word out and spread the word. But I really did it in a very grassroots kind of way. I wasn't looking to get it in the newspaper. I wanted it to have that kind of, that have a food party and then tell people when the next one is and have those who came to that one show up and bring friends and have it spread, the word spread in that way.
Right.
And that's mostly how it was done. I also posted them on my website, which the last month has been under construction, so there hasn't been much information on there that's current while it's undergoing construction. But it was really word of mouth and Facebook and then through Counterpulse that I really kept that word going. I also, part of this process was about building partnerships with community organizations and different artists in the community who are interested in this work and in this type of work. And so one of the ongoing partnerships was with the Luggage Store Gallery. They have the Tenderloin National Forest, and we partnered in a food party that's called Fresh from the Oven. And it happens outside, and we kept those going pretty much monthly through the last year, with the exception of, I think, the summer months. I was gone May through the beginning of August, and then we started them up again in September. But that's been a ongoing location and partnership for the food parties has been there.
Right. Yeah, and I was also reading that you've had some of the food parties at La Pena Cultural Center.
Yes, at La Pena, People's Grocery.
Mm-hmm. Grocery Cooperative.
So many places, let me think. I actually did a food party in the lobby of Dance Mission after dance classes.
Nice.
And, you know, I just, we did a food party. Well, we call them, actually, there's one aspect of this piece that is more along that movement that you were talking about, and it's what we call our EAT actions. And EAT stands for everybody at the table, every day at the table. And our mission statement is really to provide food and art to the people. We believe that food is nourishment everybody has a right to art and food, and food is nourishment for the body and art is nourishment for the soul. So we would go out downtown Oakland. We went to Frank Ogawa Plaza during, when we were like, late, I guess it was this time last year during the Occupy movement, and we brought pots of stew and we sang songs. And, you know, our whole thing was we didn't charge money, we didn't ask for money. What we asked for was people to tell us food stories. And that's how it's always gone down. These food parties are always free. They're potluck, but no one is ever turned away for lack of food. And the idea is to gather people to talk about food and to get to know somebody, share a meal with somebody you didn't know before you came. And but we've done them in a variety of locations and in people's homes. I did food parties in New Orleans when I was there, and it's been like that.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's great. I was thinking when you talked about the EAT actions, I was thinking about food, not bombs.
Uh-huh.
And
how,
that's, you
right.
know, you see them, you know, with these wonderful, nutritious hot meals, you know, all over
right.
the place. You know, feeding
right.
people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
I,
this.
And I,
oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go
no,
ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you know, what I love about Food Not Bombs is they really feed people. And what we do is a little bit different because it's not, you know, our whole thing is that this is an exchange. This isn't like we're just serving free meals. We're asking for your stories. So we see it as it's not the kind of thing where we're just, you know, lining up serving people food. We are exchanging energy, you know, with people. We're exchanging stories. We're telling them stories. People are telling us stories. But that's part of the exchange is that, you know, you either bring a dish to share and a story, or you definitely bring a story, but you bring yourself, and that's really that's really important at these food parties, that, you know, we're interested in what that exchange is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm from New Orleans as well, and and the 31st is big in New Orleans, so they have a voodoo fest. And I was wondering, have you ever been to New Orleans when they had the Voodoo Fest?
Yes.
As a part of the Voodoo Authentica, the shop there,
mm-hmm.
and Mama Lola.
Yep. I was there. Oh, was it 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 2 years. No, 3 years. Oh gosh, I can't keep track now. But yes, yes. And it's incredible. It's mm-hmm. incredible. New Orleans is rich. I mean, Louisiana is rich, and the heritage and around and the culture around food is really rich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So tell us what happens at Voodoo Fest, because it's really big, and it's a free community celebration. And in your dance traditions that. You know, in your choreography, you bring in voodoo.
Yes. Well, in terms of the way that, that reminds me, actually, what you're saying. We also did a food party around Mardi Gras last year, which was also the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day.
Right.
And we hired a brass band, MJ Brass Boppers, who are actually a group of musicians who relocated here after Katrina and stayed.
Mm-hmm.
But they played, and we did a procession around Market Street. It ended at Counterpulse. That's where the food party was.
Mm-hmm.
But we did that. I'm just remembering that as another food story, as a tangent. But in terms of the dance, I mean, the way that this piece works, this piece is about food, and it's about tradition and what it means to hold on. How do you hold on to tradition when some of your traditions, as I said, talking about food, they're not sustainable or they're not healthy anymore? How do you lay them to rest? How do you hold on to them? And how do you continue to hold on to this piece of who you are without, you know, with maybe having to let go of the way things were?
Mm-hmm.
How do you move into the future? So there's some aspects of the piece that are sentimental in terms of tradition and ancestry. Ancestry is big in this piece. Orisha are represented in this piece because they represent different aspects in nature, and, you know, our environment is in peril, and our food systems are part of our environment. So it's, you know, for me, those things are all very linked. And I think the other thing that this piece is really about is the women's connection to food, which is not just about, you know, it's not from a standpoint of women's issues with food, but more from the standpoint of that we are intricately linked to food. I mean, the earth is called Mother Earth, not Father Earth. And the first place, you know, that you eat aside from the earth is the womb. So it's this idea that, you know, and I'm really investigating the connection, the inherent connection of women and food. And that's something that I think in the women's movement, you know, that we had, women's liberation movement, there was this push to get away from the kitchen because the kitchen was seen as this very oppressive place. But what I'm suggesting on the contrary in this piece is that, you know, we are very linked to food. And in fact, you know, some things that I've been reading suggest that the advent of agriculture is when women's oppression began. The advent of agriculture and this idea of, you know, women being sort of owned in partnership with men as a way to secure who your offspring were, you know, to till your soil, you know, was was when women's oppression began.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking at that as how do we undo that oppression, you know, that's associated, that women are intricately linked to the food system, and how do we end that oppression of the
right.
feminine principle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I wanted to let audience know that as a part of the Our Daily Bread
mm-hmm.
at ContraPulse, November 15th through 18th. On the 18th, there's going to be a symposium, Sisters at
yes.
the Table Food Symposium, focused
yes.
on women and food. Talk
right.
about that. That's from 3 to 5, so before the performance.
Yes. Yeah, so I've invited various women who are doing different work around food. Some of them work with women farmers. Some of them are there's a few folks who are doing work with youth around farming in Oakland. And there's a woman who's coming who's going to speak on women's eating disorders among women and with a specific focus on women of color and eating disorders. And it's this idea of bringing these women together at the table to contemplate this notion that, you know, if we are the source, of, you know, if we're intricately linked to food in this way, and that our oppression is linked to food, then how do we look at taking that power back? And I mean that from a place of creating balance, because we're out of balance. We're out of balance with nature, and how do we as women be on the forefront of, you know, bringing balance back, if we even can do that at the rate of, you know, based on where we are environmentally at this point with global warming and everything, but how do we, you know, really find that balance and that, you know, in some form or fashion, because, yes, you know, as some people say there's time, but it has to be now, and some people say it's too late, and some people say it's not an issue, but, you know, what are the steps that we need to take amongst ourselves to be at the forefront of, you know, restoring balance?
Mm-hmm. Right. I want to let the audience
yeah.
know that the panelists include Ashara Ekudayo,
yeah.
Who is a food justice activist, and
mm-hmm.
she's going to moderate the panel. Gail Myers,
That's
executive
right.
director and
Gail
founder
Myers.
Of Farms to Grow.
Yes.
And Tiny, mm-hmm. Also known as Lisa Gray Garcia,
yes.
and she's a homeless advocate, Poor News Network
yes.
Founder, and has a regular radio show. And she's
yes.
also an author. And then Mary Gee and others.
Yes. Yes.
So that should be really a very intense and powerful gathering.
Yeah, I think it'll be really rich. And, mm-hmm. you know, as with most of the events that I do around food, there's a very informal nature to it. I think we've had enough of this idea of a panel being removed from an audience who listens passively, but we're going to be looking at ways to engage those who show up in the discussion as they get to know these various participants who are doing this work. How does the audience become more engaged other than just the Q&A period that generally follows most panels? But that's been the spirit in which I've been having the food parties. And we'll be continuing with that with the sisters at the table.
And another place where you showed up, I believe, last year as well, was at SOMARTS on one of their Tuesday evening food and poetry, and that was so fun.
Yeah, that was great. And I was doing that with Ron Reagan, who is a poet and singer and very dear friend. And he was doing poetry at that event. He was presenting some of his work that he's been doing around food. And so, you know, these are the ways that I like to work in partnership with various artists and activists, is to show up and support them, perform or cook at their events. Because I, you know, one of the things I really believe, anytime I believe as an artist, when we're doing work around social justice, there's no one voice that carries that message exclusively or should want to. So I, you know, there's various artists. Tracy Bartlow has this piece that she's been working on that I'm really looking forward to. Tracy Bartlow, an amazing dancer, choreographer, and theater maker, and she has a piece about her own food story, and she's got this wonderful garden in her backyard in West Oakland, and she comes from a long line of people who grew food. Her mother always had a garden that they ate out of. Her grandfather had a huge garden. I think he sold produce that he grew from his garden in Texas. And so she has a piece, one-woman show, that's based on her history of coming